Today is the first day of a six-week open enrollment period for the Hawaii Health Insurance Exchange established under the Affordable Care Act, and it's a critical time for Hawaii's uninsured populations. As with most matters related to today's healthcare landscape, the details can be confusing, so the Legal Aid Society of Hawaii is lending a hand. We asked Connie Liu, the Society's Managing Attorney for Community Engagement, to help us sort it out.
Open enrollment is the period of time that individuals and families can apply for insurance on the marketplace. This is when they can file their application and see what plans that are available to them and what kind of help they can receive to help pay for some of those plans.
And what steps should they take?
Well, one of the things they can do is they can check out the healthcare.gov website and apply online from there, or they can also call the healthcare.gov toll-free number to receive assistance. Legal Aid is also providing assistance with face-to-face, what they call navigators, to help people apply for health insurance. And we're usually doing outreaches to help different individuals apply.
Who are the people most likely to benefit from this?
I think a lot of people who are slightly above the federal poverty level, so they don't qualify for Medicaid, but they don't have like full-time jobs or part-time jobs that cover their insurance. They would be the people who would benefit the most from this program.
How many of those people roughly are there in Hawaii, do you think?
You know, I'm really not sure about that. I am aware that, you know, especially with the Compact of Free Association, there are people who do come over here during different periods, and they could be some of the people who could benefit from this program.
Meaning the Micronesian population.
Correct.
And how, why that population in particular?
Well, when they first arrive, they might not have health insurance. And they might not qualify for the MedQuest or Medicaid insurance. Often you need to be either a child or you need to be 65 years or older, disabled or blind in order to qualify for the MedQuest insurance. So there's a gap of people who don't fall in that range. The people from the Micronesian communities who are in that gap, they could apply for the insurance on the marketplace and possibly get some help from the state to pay for some of their premiums. They do need to be below a certain income limit in order to qualify, and they do need to make sure they are denied from Medicaid in order to qualify through this program.
When you say federal poverty level, what is that now?
I believe at 100% we're looking at maybe about $1,200 a month or so for a single person. Sorry, I don't know the figures right off the top of my head, but that's about approximate.
Mm-hmm. And that's those are people less likely to have insurance through their employer, people with part-time jobs.
Right. So these would be people who are probably a little bit above that $1,200 or so per month for a single person threshold, and still can't quite afford health insurance on their own.
The facilitators that Legal Aid provides, what did you refer to them as?
They're called health navigators or kokuas.
Uh-huh.
We have a total, I believe, six of them. A majority of them do speak Chukis. One speaks Kushrayan. We also have another one on the Big Island to help people apply for their insurance.
Is there a way for people on other islands to reach out to you if you don't have one of them?
Sure. They can always call our main hotline. That number is 808-536-4302, and a prompt will come up to ask them to press 2 to get help with health insurance. And when they call us, we will screen the calls and try to be able to help them.
Are you sufficiently staffed to reach out to everyone who needs reaching out to?
Well, we're doing the best that we can
sure.
with our staff. We can always use more people, but, we'll do what we can.
It's a six-week open enrollment period, and that is in compliance with the Affordable Care Act. It's under the terms of the ACA.
Right.
What's the link here?
So, yeah, so they determined that the that the open enrollment period was going to be from November 1st to December 15.
Right.
Last year, I believe it was November 1st to January 31st. So it's a lot shortened this year compared to the previous year.
What is the cost sharing reduction? You were telling me that the federal government is taking that away.
They were reducing it at least, and cost share reduction is a discount that lowers the amount you have to pay for deductibles, co-payments, and co-insurance. And there is some fear that that might affect how much people need to pay out of pocket and how insurers would react to that change in the reduction in the cost share reduction help.
And how have they reacted?
Well, fortunately for Hawaii, you know, Kaiser and HMSA have, you know, stepped it up so that people don't need to really be too concerned about that. So that's a good thing on our end.
Connie Liu is the managing attorney for community engagement for the Legal Aid Society of Hawaii. Open enrollment begins today and goes until December 15th. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, how much does a growing region affect the flavor of coffee? But first, your quiz. We'll be talking about the upcoming Kona Coffee Festival later in the program. So for today's backyard quiz, we thought about some four-legged critters brought to West Hawaii as beasts of burden for the burgeoning coffee trade. For decades, they played an essential role in West Hawaii coffee farms, able to sure-footedly traverse lava fields and carry heavy loads at high elevations. Their job has long since been supplanted by all-terrain vehicles, and today they're a growing feral population. They're sociable creatures, and when left alone at night, have been known to call out loudly to others of their kind. The sound of their braying in the dead of night has led to their colorful nickname, and that's what we're looking for today. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, whose Kidney Cars program provides funding for community health and education services. Learn more about vehicle donation at kidneyhi.org.
I'm Bert Lum.
And I'm Ryan Ozawa.
Today on Bite Marsh Cafe, we'll hear about programs that tap citizen scientists to map Hawaii's natural resources.
Equipped with mobile devices and apps, one training program is developing citizen foresters, and another encourages breadfruit tree adoptions.
That's today at 6:30 p.m. on Bite Marsh Cafe.
Bridget Cambria was hired to counsel kids who had come to the U.S. seeking refuge. Instead,
I learned how to restrain children, I learned how to shackle children. I learned how to strip search children. All the things that you would find in a normal prison.
Why this country detains immigrant kids for months, even years. On the next Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
This evening at 7, following Bite Marks Cafe.
Stephen Salaita is an American scholar, author, and public speaker in the realm of Arab-American studies. And he has seen at first hand what happens when an unpopular opinion is uttered in an academic setting. Some of his experiences may make you wonder if academic freedom of speech is as free as it's cracked up to be. He's in Hawaii to relate the Israeli occupation of the West Bank to the experiences of Native Americans and Native Hawaiians. And he's with us in our studio. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Chris.
Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me on.
What's your field of concentration, and what is the point that you're looking to make when you speak to academic audiences around the country?
Sure. I do Native American studies, Arab American studies, and indigenous studies more broadly. That's what I was trained in doctoral school, and that's what a lot of my scholarship and public speaking focuses on. And I'm trying to make historical connections among indigenous communities across the globe and trying to look at where they have points of shared struggle, shared history, and a potential for sort of working together to develop some of their social and political aspirations.
Are we in a kind of post-colonial world today where we're seeing a lot of the after effects of, 100 years ago, colonialism dominated a lot of human society around the world, didn't it?
It did, and it still does in some cases. So while I would say that the description post-colonial accurately describes significant portions of the world, much of the planet is still colonized. Palestine is one of those places. There are lots of parts of the Pacific and North America that can still be described as colonized. And so it's those areas of the world where they're still dealing with foreign settlement or still dealing with military occupation that I'm interested in.
Do the places that are colonized necessarily know that they're colonized?
I think most of them do. Probably members of the colonial society don't always know it, but the natives certainly do.
The colonizers don't necessarily admit it that freely. Yeah?
That's right.
Well, because, you could certainly describe Hawaii in its past as an American colony, and there are many who would say that prevails today in a lot of ways.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I would say that it still meets the many of the classic definitions of a colonized space.
You have related that to the West Bank.
Sure.
And when you do, you get some pushback, don't you?
I do, yes.
Why?
Well, it's a controversial issue. Anybody who deals with Israel-Palestine knows that people have very visceral emotional responses to the issue. People are deeply invested in it. The public fights that people have around the issue are legion, and I've certainly been involved with them at different points in my life. So
yeah,
my hands aren't free of that either. I've done plenty of arguing publicly and privately, and so it's just sensitive. But I think part of the reason that it's sensitive is because it is still ongoing in a very explicit way, and it's yet to be worked out. So people are invested not so much in getting a narrative across, but they're invested in trying to push for a certain outcome that would fit their politics. So for me, I'm interested in an outcome that's favorable to Palestinian freedom. But I think for a lot of other people, maybe my political opponents, the ideal outcome would be one in which Israel prevails. So the fact that the two societies, Palestinian and Israeli, are still in such heated conflict means that the arguments and the rhetoric are also going to be heated as well.
It also means that resolution is not exactly on the horizon.
It doesn't seem that way, no.
Is there, anything that, if you were suddenly given the power, would there be a way to move that particular conflict towards some resolution?
I think so. If I were given the power, and I don't know who would bestow me that power, but
scary thought,
exactly. But if somebody were foolish enough to do that, I prefer a binational solution, one in which the borders get erased or mitigated, and and everybody, regardless of faith background, of religious background, has equal rights and equal access to protection under the law. The two solutions that you hear bandied about and argued are the classic two-state solution, where the West Bank and Gaza Strip would become a future Palestinian state living side by side with Israel and a shared Jerusalem as the capital. But a lot of people, both political idealists and political realists, are beginning to show some skepticism about that possibility, given the large amount of Israeli settlements that exist in the West Bank. And so a lot of people, intellectuals, even some politicians, are thinking about binationalism as a possibility. The argument against it is that the vast majority of Israelis would not accept that outcome. But at the same time, I would say, you know, the vast majority of Israeli settlers won't accept an outcome where they're asked to pack up and leave and go back into pre-1967 Israel either. So no matter what solution is going to get found or implemented, a significant percentage of people are going to be unhappy.
Historically, and this is across the board, once people get power, once they get territory, they don't like to give it up.
That's correct. Exactly. Unless they're forced by a competing or a larger power to do so, they don't.
That would seem to be the cycle of human history and the cycle that gets us in trouble again and again.
Certainly modern history, yeah. But there is precedent with Israel doing it. It still controls the Gaza Strip by sea, by land and by air, but it did remove its settlers from the Gaza Strip recently. And, of course, after the 1967 war, Israel occupied the entire Sinai Peninsula of Egypt and ended up leaving it in I want to get my dates correct. The peace agreement, I think, was signed in 1979, and they ended up withdrawing from Sinai in the early 1980s, 1982 or 1983, I believe. So there is some precedent there, but it's never been an easy process, and it certainly requires intervention of a greater power. And in this case, the only greater power is the United States.
Which is unlikely to intervene.
Correct.
In a way that makes anyone happy, I would think.
Correct.
Steve, it's good to talk to you, and I look forward to hearing what you say at your presentations in Hawaii. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
Stephen Salaita is the author of Internationalism, Decolonizing Native America and Palestine. He'll be taking part in several local speaking engagements this week, and you can find the details for them on our Facebook page, The Conversation.
Straighten up and fly right with the U.S. Air Force Band of the Pacific. On November 11th, their Small Kind Acoustic Ensemble will be rocking your favorite tunes in a free concert in HPR's Atherton Studio. Reserve your seat at hprtickets.org or by calling 955-8821 during business hours. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership, Wealth Management.
When homeless populations are swept from their semi-permanent settlements, where do they go? No one seems to be able to answer definitively. When they try, the numbers they provide vary widely. We know more about the disruptive side of compassionate disruption than we know about where people end up. Natanya Friedheim has that story in today's Civil Beat Reality Check. Good morning, Natanya.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Sure. We've been hearing a lot about the sweeps this past week, especially there's some, you know, major sweeps still underway through mid-November, but that's the unanswered question, isn't it? Where do they go?
Exactly. And there are some numbers that are collected after sweeps, mostly by outreach workers who will go out before the sweep happens to tell people who are living on the streets that they're not allowed to, you know, stay there when the sweep happens, and try to direct them to services that might be helpful. And those social workers will report back to city or state officials. But the numbers are very hard to track. And sometimes even if somebody says they're going to a shelter or staying with family, you don't really know if they're actually going, to that place.
I would imagine that a lot of people in a homeless community, when asked by an authority figure what they're going to do, would give them the answer they thought they wanted to hear.
Yeah, trust is a big issue. A lot of people who are homeless don't trust, you know, sometimes they don't trust social workers. And a lot of the time, especially, they don't trust state or city officials who are doing the sweeping. So it's difficult to, you know, sometimes it's difficult to even offer services because oftentimes they just don't want it.
Well, because in that world, there are an awful lot of people who have really disengaged from a lot of the, you know, manifestations of society. They just don't want to hear about it. I can't imagine that everyone would provide information about themselves freely.
Definitely. And oftentimes people will be interested in permanent housing, but not be interested in a shelter. And that's one thing to note. There are shelter beds available, but permanent housing units are much more difficult to find.
And to date, if I have this right, Natanya, the city and county of Honolulu has not yet gone into the safe zones policy, right? They're not doing what they're doing on Hawaii Island.
Exactly, not yet. They're definitely talking about it both on a city level, and the conversation about safe zones among city council members has changed from recommending that the city create safe zones for like a tent city where it's okay to set up camp to a tiny home setup similar to Hale Mauleola on Sand Island. But there's also a conversation going on at the state level that's more open to tent cities.
It looks as if something has to give, don't you think, Natanya? I mean, with the extent of these sweeps and the, you know, the vagueness about where people are going to end up, you have to think some kind of change is in the offing.
Definitely. It seems like, you know, public officials are moving closer to the idea of safe zones. Whether or not that's going to actually help the state's homeless crisis remains to be seen.
Well, whether anything is going to help that crisis remains to be seen, yeah?
That's the million-dollar question, yes.
I'm afraid so. Thanks very much, Natanya.
Thanks for having me.
Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat, today featuring reporting fellow Natanya Friedheim. Holidays get us thinking about the people we don't think about often enough, the people who will go to bed hungry tonight. The Hawaii Food Bank's year-round effort to keep those people fed is stepped up over the holidays, and Kim Bartenstein, the Director of Mission and Quality Assurance at the Hawaii Food Bank, brings us up to date.
The Hawaii Food Bank feeds about 20% of our population. So one in out of every fifth person needs some type of food assistance throughout the year.
Mm-hmm.
So that's huge. So our mission, you know, is to make sure 365 days of the year we're feeding people. So, you know, that's a huge undertaking. You know, with the community help, you know, that's how we get our job done. Just, you know, making sure that we have enough food at the warehouse, making sure that, you know, funds are coming into the warehouse so that we can purchase food if we need to. And we have so many other different programs. So, you know, just making sure that all of those are running.
So many efforts of the food bank and other efforts like it tend to surface in our consciousness around the holidays.
Definitely. You know, you're having dinner with your family, and what about those people that don't have?
Yeah.
So, yeah, we're definitely top of mind.
But that sort of disguises the fact that you have, as you said, a 365-day mission.
Right, yeah. You know, so, you know, a lot of schools and businesses call during this time to, you know, do food drives, do fun drives, which is great. But definitely the message is we have to feed people 365 days, so we always are doing food drives. We're always fundraising at some level, grant writing, whatever that is, to make sure that we continue to feed people in the community.
Are you able to keep your supplies up pretty consistently throughout the year?
You know, we have an ebb and flow.
Yeah,
you know, so, you know, during the holiday season, of course, top of mind, like we said, so, you know, we're a little bit higher on numbers, so we get closer to a 30-day. Right now, we're about an 18-day, which is pretty normal, and sometimes we dip below that, you know, as we're coming into the summer.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then we have kids out of school. So, you know, we have to make sure we have food in the warehouse so that we can do our programs with Sodexo to feed the kids during summer programs. So, you know, we just always have to be mindful about making sure we're at a good level.
When you say 18 day, you reckon it in terms, your supply in terms of number of days it would feed the hungry population?
Right, yeah. So right now we have, you know, if something was to happen, you know, let's say, God forbid, we had a huge storm and, mm-hmm. you know, we wouldn't be able to sustain what we need to. Obviously, we would probably be one of the sources they would come to for food. Mm-hmm. Like in Iki, you know, we sent food to Kauai. So, you know, we always want to try to have a good level of food.
And you've been able to calculate sort of how many days, how many people really do the math on the subject, sounds like.
Yeah, you know, we definitely, you know, everything kind of is done by poundage and what comes in and out of our warehouse. So, you know, we distribute about 52,000 pounds a day. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's over 1 million pounds a month. So we definitely kind of have a handle on, you know, where we're at so that we know.
What kind of guidelines do you have for people who want to donate? I mean, what kind of food works best?
Right. So, you know, we're always kind of focused towards canned goods. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the canned proteins, the meats, the Spams, the Vienna sausage, things like that. Canned meals are great for families, you know. Rice. Hawaii loves rice.
Yeah,
so rice
yeah.
is definitely on our top five. Fruits, vegetables, those types of things. But more towards the canned goods is kind of what we always encourage, mm-hmm. Besides monetary donations.
Yeah. So that whatever keeps the longest. And
Yeah, because, you know, it tends to, you know, we do have a lot of dry goods, but like you said, it doesn't hold as long as a canned good would. So that's why we always focus our efforts there.
And plenty of warehouse space?
Yeah, we have a nice little warehouse in Mapunapuna, about 23,000 square feet. Kind of look like Costco inside.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so racks and, you know, refrigerated units so we can hold our food.
What kind of staff does it take year-round to keep all this going?
You know, we have a staff of, I think about, we're like about 35 staff members that does fundraising, operations. But, you know, we do depend a lot on volunteers. So we get great volunteers to come in daily and help us salvage or go through the food to make sure it's safe so we can distribute it. We have a lot of volunteers to come in to help us do our senior food box program to pack that, our cakey backpack to pack that. So we really do rely on a lot of volunteer needs.
So somebody who is suddenly motivated to contribute, what would you have them do at this time of the year?
Yeah, so you can, you know, they can go on our website, hawaiifoodbank.org, and they can find all the volunteer opportunities that we have coming up. Like I said, whether it's coming on a Saturday to help us pack boxes or cakey backpack to pack our, you know, cakey backpack, come into the warehouse, spend some hours with us, 3 to 4 hours just going through food, you know, that's really what's needed so we can get the food back out our doors as quickly as possible.
And where can people drop off donations?
So they can drop off donations directly to our warehouse at 2611 Kilihau Street. You can go to any Ruby Tuesday. They're year-round. Napa is year-round. And also you can go on our website because there's a lot of community events going on, and they'll take community donations.
Kim Bartenstein is the Director of Mission and Quality Assurance at the Hawaii Food Bank. And you can get more information about the food bank on our Facebook page, The Conversation. For 10 days a year, West Hawaii celebrates its coffee culture, and there's plenty to celebrate. The industry has survived the coffee borer berry beetle, the pest that has threatened its survival, and seems to be thriving today. In advance of this weekend's start to the Kona Coffee and Cultural Festival, we talked with coffee consultant Sean Steinman about the way Kona coffee has hung on to its status as a luxury item.
The industry's done a really good job of presenting itself as being a specialty product.
Mm-hmm.
And I think even though not all of the coffee it produces is really geeky, I think enough people are turning to it and there's enough promotion that they're trying it out.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's enough wealthy people out there also who can afford it. And I think the reputation is as strong as ever.
When you say geeky, you're referring to the gourmet coffee audience, which seems to be growing, yeah?
Yes. Not just gourmet in the I want to appear to be gourmet, but mm-hmm. the people who really want complexity.
Mm-hmm.
The folks who want their coffee not to taste like coffee, but to taste like something else.
The people who actually know what you're talking about when you talk about the nose and all
yes,
that.
Yes, absolutely. Okay. That seems rather pretentious.
Yeah. What are you talking about when you talk about that stuff? Well, you know, what do terms like that refer to that the real coffee connoisseur understands?
It's really just like I mentioned. You know, when you can taste coffee or wine or cheese or chocolate, and you can taste other things.
Uh-huh.
And they're not complicated things. Sometimes it's a fruit that you're familiar with. Sometimes it's a sweet thing you're familiar with. But you taste it in that object, and it really tastes like it's there. It's not there, of course. Nobody's added it. But maybe the molecules are similar or the same, or there's just the way your brain's working. But all of a sudden, you get it tasting like something and smelling like something that's not coffee.
What are some of the notes that are heard or felt in Hawaii coffee?
I think in Hawaii we get a lot of citrus, mostly lemon, but occasionally some other things seem familiar.
Mm-hmm.
We get some nutty and spicy. We get chocolatey. We could definitely get fruity, sometimes floral.
How do you go about introducing something like that? Can you set out to have a coffee that, you know, has a lily koi note to it?
To create it, you mean?
Yeah.
No, we have no idea how that happens.
Really?
There's a couple of good steps to take, right? You might choose a different variety. You might try to grow at a particular temperature or higher mm-hmm. elevation. And that will increase your chances for something like that happening.
Mm-hmm.
But we really have no idea. We know that something that's quite new, actually, is after you harvest coffee, you've got to get all the layers off and dry it down.
Right.
And one of the ways we traditionally get off the layers is you squeeze off the fruit and there's a sticky mucilage and you can soak that in water overnight and it ferments.
Uh-huh.
You can, much like you can with beer or wine, you can populate that fermenting with yeasts, particular yeasts, and that has an influence on the end flavor. Not a huge influence, but a little bit. And we're just learning now that this is true and that we can do it.
What's the end result? Something like beer / coffee? Or?
It's not beery, it's just more complexity. Maybe more fruit, more flower, less edge, less bitter, less negative things, and can be more positive things. Now, I've tasted some of these experiments that have gone wrong, just the way you might with beer or wine.
Uh-huh.
So it's not like we have the answers, but we know that we can. But this is one more place where flavor can happen.
Well, tasting the stuff that's gone wrong is part of your job at the front lines.
Right? Yeah, of course. It's really fascinating, actually.
Does the fermented coffee product have alcohol in it?
Not the coffee itself. The liquid does. Because what happens is that the critters are eating this sugary substance in the water. And they eat, they ferment, they make alcohol, and it's in that liquid. But then we throw that out.
Uh-huh. What would it be if you kept it? Would it be something like the fermented tea that we were seeing, kombucha?
Oh, that's a good question.
Let's create a new product right here and now, Sean.
It's a great idea. You know, people have tried a lot to make coffee, alcohol from coffee waste products like the fruit and the mucilage.
Right.
But I've never seen it available, which makes me think that it's not that good.
We can't, you know, you can't hold back from discovery with things like that, Sean.
Right.
Who knows?
Somebody will drink the alcohol.
Well, you know, combining booze and coffee meets a lot of people's dreams, wouldn't mm-hmm. you think?
Irish coffee, classic pairing.
There you go. How many different really important growing centers are there in the Hawaiian Islands these days? How many different islands are giving us coffee? We hear about Molokai, Maui, who else?
Yeah,
Big
Kauai,
Island, obviously.
Big Island, and here on Oahu.
Mm-hmm.
So five islands concertedly growing coffee, and within islands, various regions. So the Big Island, there's four defined regions. The way the state defines regions in Hawaii is by county.
Uh-huh.
So there's only one county in Oahu, so
right.
There's only one, technically one political designation. But there's folks growing coffee in Manawili, and there's folks growing coffee on the North Shore. So do we want to separate those geographically? I think so, but...
Well, when you define a region, as you say, four different regions on Hawaii Island, What are the criteria? Elevation, soil, that kind of thing?
No, it's strictly political. So the district of Hamakua, the district of Kau, district of Kona, and the district of Hilo.
But from the coffee point of view,
what becomes more important?
You draw an entirely different map.
Yes,
you?
Absolutely. And it leads, well, so that question leads to a bigger idea of how is flavor and place connected? Right, that's really what we're after.
That was the question I was trying to ask you.
Right. Is there really something about a place that makes a flavor?
Yeah.
And for almost any crop, the answer is unknown from a scientific perspective. Generally dubious that a place itself, or maybe I should be more specific, a specific thing about a place, right? The soil itself, or the climate itself, or mm-hmm. the humidity itself. Probably mm-hmm. any one of those things is not important. But a combination of things, and the combination of how a farmer interacts with that, and they interact with the genetics, all these things probably influence mm-hmm. the end. Well, we know they influence the end taste.
We're always hearing those claims about wine, though. It's from this or that region, and that makes all the difference. So those are somewhat dubious, those claims?
It's dubious because from a soil science perspective, it's hard to explain why that might happen. It doesn't mean it isn't happening, mm-hmm. but no one's been able to prove it or explain it.
Oh.
What someone has come up with, which is really interesting, and this is goes to the same idea in coffee we were just talking about, how the yeast that you use to ferment could influence flavor.
Yeah.
With wine, you can imagine different regions where wine is grown, that there are different microorganisms on the fruit. Mm-hmm. So when you go to ferment that wine, those organisms, in fact, are what's playing the role in the flavor versus the soil.
Mm-hmm.
And something else we don't tend to think about a lot with production of these products is that there's a lot of steps involved in fermenting wine or brewing or creating coffee to be roasted. And each of those steps can do something. And historically, people have just done it and hoped they got it right. And when they got it right, they just kept doing that same thing. But as we learn more and more about the scientific process that's going on, we modify the process and we clean it up. So a great example with wine is how wine has always been done in wood barrels, but there's a lot of variation there. If you can do wine in a metal barrel that you can clean and sterilize, all of a sudden you can fine-tune your product to become consistent with it. And it's going to be different than those sort of random wine barrel bits. And what we're learning then is the idea of terroir, the idea that flavors from a place might not be from the soil place, but from all the little things that influence it that we don't even think about.
Critters living in the soil.
Critters, human action, mistakes, mm-hmm. traditions. You know, like the story about, it's a great story about a meat plant somewhere that had, you know, the person would get their, would finish a product and they had to wheel it around the company to get it to this next destination. And the company finally built a new place, and they had a cleaner system, and they didn't have to make that chaotic
uh-huh.
travail. And the product didn't taste the same. And there was something that was happening while the person was walking around with the stuff, that uh-huh. some environmental accident.
Probably some impurity that happened to taste good.
Or like he walked through a certain room, and there was something in that room that landed on it. I don't remember the bit of the story.
The point of the story.
Right. But there was something. I think it was a This American Life story, actually.
Yeah.
And it was a great story.
Well, you know, the whole idea that there are things to be learned in a subject that's been as studied as long as coffee has is encouraging in a way.
Very encouraging. I mean, I'm an academic at heart, so to me, of course, it's charming at best. At worst.
Well, what would you most like to know, you know, if you were given one mystery of coffee growing to unravel? What kind of questions would you want answered?
I really want to approach that problem of how does this thing we're doing create this taste? Or what are the things that I'm doing in those tastes? How much can I, as a farmer, create or alter the flavor by fertilizing, by watering, by, you know, what kind of fertilizer? Or am I using chemicals? Do any of these things really, they have a true effect, or are they an accidental effect?
Yeah.
I'm a scientist who cares about taste, and so I want to, that's what I want to play with. If I were going to be an academic the rest of my career, that's what I would do.
It's kind of what variables do what, in a sense.
Yeah. And then you can consciously manipulate them. Right? Oh, I want my coffee to be more like this, so I'm going to do this thing. Like, that to me is neat.
Sean Steinman is the owner of Daylight Mind Coffee Company and the founder of Coffea Consulting, which conducts research on the science of coffee, including biochemistry, entomology, brewing, and sensory analysis. He's one of the organizers of the competition at the Kona Coffee Cultural Festival, which runs from November 3rd to the 12th at various locations around West Hawaii. You can find details in today's edition of the Conversation podcast on hawaiipublicradio.org.
Aloha, I'm Paris Starn, and I'm from Honolulu, Hawaii. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
In today's backyard quiz, we're thinking about a four-legged creature that will forever be identified with West Hawaii coffee farms. These donkeys were brought to the Kona side of Hawaii Island as sure-footed beasts of burden, able to navigate the tricky terrain of the region's coffee farms and carry heavy saddlebags as they stepped through lava fields. At night, they could be heard calling out to one another, braying from farm to farm. Today, they're a feral population, their usefulness to coffee farmers long expired. Because they range freely in the Waikoloa area, residents are concerned about their impact on populated areas, especially on roadways at night. The plaintive sound of their braying gave rise to their nickname, and that's what we asked you about today. These furry beasts are called Kona nightingales, and that's our quiz today. Laura from Kamauela got that right. She was the first to get it right, and as she said, she just passed one on the road. I would expect someone from Kamauela to know the answer to that, because it's very much part of their lives there. That's today's quiz. If you've got one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Tax code, as we all know, is complicated. How, though, did it get that way?
People like to cheat, and they like to take advantage of the rules.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Loopholes, deductions, exemptions, oh my. That story, the rest of the day's business news, and the numbers from Wall Street, of course, next time on Marketplace.
This evening at 6, right after All Things Considered.
India's raga music has been creeping into Western consciousness for decades, affecting the music of everyone from the Beatles to John Coltrane. In their purest form, ragas demand total immersion, and performances can go on for hours. Brooklyn Raga Massive is a contemporary ensemble, a collective rooted in Indian classical music, whose music travels along a continuum from tradition to innovation. That's the name of their Sunday concert at the Honolulu Museum of Art's Doris Duke Theater, sponsored by the East-West Center. They're touring the islands, and Neil Murgai from the band is on the line with us now. Good morning, Neil.
Good morning, Chris. Thanks for having me.
There's what, 11 of you, Neil?
There's 10 musicians. 11 of us made the trip with some concession help.
Uh-huh.
We'll also be performing on November 4th at Kahilu Theater in the Big Island.
What's your instrumentation, Neil?
We have sitar, tabla, drum set, Indian flute, which is called bansuri.
Mm-hmm.
We have an Indian violinist, a Western violinist, guitar, bass, and drums, as well as a singer and hammer dulcimer. So we got quite the group.
You do have quite the group, and that allows you, that instrumentation allows you to go in any number of different directions, doesn't it?
That's right. We have great flexibility. We have a great concert planned for everybody, including Indian classical music, songs that are composed by or inspired by masters such as John Coltrane and Pandit Ravi Shankar, as well as originals from members of our group.
Let's play a quick excerpt, Neil, from your Coltrane Raga tribute album. This is called India.
India. This is John Coltrane's India. We do a whole set of music at some concerts that is of John and Alice Coltrane's composition.
Well, let's hear it. Neil, I was a big fan of John Coltrane, and I remember getting his My Favorite Things album, in which he and the pianist McCoy Tyner go into quite an extended improvisation that has an Eastern flavor, doesn't it?
Definitely. John Coltrane was inspired by Indian music. He met Pandit Ravi Shankar and took some lessons with him, and at the very last stages of his life was really practicing a lot of Indian scales and Middle Eastern scales. And was very inspired by it. So many of us in the Brooklyn Raga Massive have grown up listening to John Coltrane and been inspired by him. And so now we're taking it back and applying some raga flavors onto his music.
Because one of the things that he did in the Indian influenced music that he did was kind of go to where ragas go, which is almost to an extended sort of trance state. Yeah.
Absolutely, extended trance and ecstatic form, that was the place that he was achieving and that we are definitely aiming towards, for sure.
I once heard his ensemble with Alice Coltrane, his second wife, at the very near the end of his life, and it was very much, it was very fiery, very powerful. They played one song for 45 minutes, and everybody kind of improvised at once. Do you do a little bit of that?
We definitely go to those territories. In places, we probably won't be playing as long songs as that on this show, but we definitely like to extend the boundaries and let the music go where it takes us. And we're also celebrating the release of our CD of In C, Terry Riley's In C, and we'll be performing that for as a second set for about 45 minutes, which will be another ecstatic journey performing this iconic minimalist classic. Yep. We're the first group to play that with Indian instruments.
And that's very much an indicator of how, particularly when Pandit Ravi Shankar's music first hit the West, it was really, you know, he would play sold-out concerts. He became a very popular musician. Probably for a lot of people's ears because the Beatles started adding sitar, didn't they?
Exactly. George Harrison was learning with Pandit Ravi Shankar and added sitar to many songs, Within You, Without You, so many others.
Yeah.
Great Inner Light was the B-side. That was a great track. They did so much, and that really popularized sitar in the West at that time.
Can you apply sitar to any different type of music, you know, to Western music? I mean, it uses a very different scale than Western music, doesn't it?
Well, it is many different scales. Rag literally means that which colors the mind. And you can use scales that are ascending and maybe different descending and
yeah.
characteristic phrases. But the notes themselves are closer to just intonation. So not quite lining up with the piano, but, you know, I have frets, I can move my frets, and I can tune up and play with guitarists and pianists, which we do regularly. I definitely have learned to read Western music and to be able to play with any instrument from anywhere in the world, really.
Because it's extremely intricate. I know that where we have a 12-tone scale to move from one note to the next note that's consonant, you might have 20 or more within that same tonal range, yeah?
Yes, as I think 21 or 22 shrutis they're called. Now, in practice, we really use the same kind of seven notes or 12 chromatic notes, and then the shrutis are more just kind of maybe sometimes like the major third will be, or the minor third will be just a little bit more flat, or the minor sixth will just be a little bit more flat from where it is in Western music. And so in certain ragas, it moves a little bit. But mostly the shrutis are kind of vibrato and ornamentation and not specific notes. So we can play with the typical tunings.
That flatting of the third is not that different from what a blues guitarist does.
It's very similar, for sure.
Well, good luck in your island shows, and thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much, Chris. Look forward to seeing everybody at the concert.
All right. Brooklyn Raga Massive will perform at Hawaii Island's Kahilu Theater on Saturday, And at the Doris Duke Theater on Honolulu in Honolulu on Sunday, a companion exhibition of Indian art will be open to the public through the East-West Center's arts program. And you can find links to all of those shows on the Conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Aloha, I'm Marcia Rose Joyner. If you like today's music, go to the Conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org for a playlist.
It's Just Jobim, an evening of music by beloved singer-songwriter Antonio Carlos Jobim in the Atherton Studio on November 4th. HPR's own Sandy Sukiyama, host of Brazilian Experience, serenades you with his classic bossa nova tunes. Reserve your seats by calling 955-8821 during business hours or go to hprtickets.org. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
And that's it for today's edition of The Conversation. Up tomorrow, we'll look at crime prevention through youth outreach. We'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave your comments at this number, 808-792-8217. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at The Conversation. Tweet us at HI Conversation. If you missed any of the show or want a past one, find them on the Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook. Join us tomorrow.